Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. This season has been a lot about rebels. From nuns to biddies to punks to mobsters, we've loved looking at Hellraisers. And in the 70s and 80s, there was a trio of UK actors just as known for their substance-fueled antics as their powerful performances. We've already discussed Oliver Reed in detail. I'm sure we're going to get around to Richard Burton at some point, but today we'll focus on Lawrence of Arabia himself, Peter O'Toole. How much of an alcohol-abusing womanizer he actually was and how much was his own mythologizing is currently up for debate, but what you can't debate is how strong an actor he was. Cam, do you have a favorite O'Toole performance?
Yeah, I don't think I'm very like that interesting. I think that, the thing is, his best performances are the big ones, usually. I think Lion in Winter is one that I really personally like. I'm not a huge Lawrence of Arabia guy, but just because I don't think I've seen, like, I haven't seen it on the big screen, you know, whatever.
Well, then epic, you right? haven't yeah, seen it, is what I would say.
Go back to
and
selling
if you
tickets
had,
at 10.
I'd say if you haven't seen 70 millimeter, yeah, then yeah, you yeah. haven't
exactly.
seen it.
So yeah. Anyway, that's why it's like King Ralph. I think he's good in anything. We have him on Phantoms on Hollywood Suite at the moment. I think he's quite funny. Well, the one that I would point out that maybe people don't know, I really like The Ruling Class, where he's
I was just going to talk about that one.
Maniac.
That's the tops.
Yeah. It kind of comes in and out of circulation, so I think it's a little less known. But he's good at anything. I mean, the other one that I think is maybe sad, question mark, he's really great in Ratatouille as the voice of the critic.
Yeah.
What a nice late role. Yeah.
He's very disturbing in future film on the podcast, Kingdom of Heaven, as the like decaying, I assume he has the bubonic plague man whose face is falling apart.
Oh.
That I think I'm not just picture. This is not a nightmare.
I've never seen.
Happen, right?
No, I've never seen Kingdom of Heaven.
I haven't seen it yet. So we'll you know what? We're going to put a pin in this one and we're going to come back to it
Sorry.
Later.
Yeah.
But it's all good. But he's another one of those actors who, like, I mean, yes, he's an incredible actor, but I feel like his tabloidness is what kind of kept him going and why people would come to see him. And some of my favorite stories that he has. Now, there was a big biography put out with like a ton of his antics, and like it really highlighted what, you know, some of the terrible things he did were, especially when it came to women. But there's also a new one coming out that supposedly says he invented most of those stories. He just liked people to think that that's the way he was. And I think the truth falls somewhere in the middle.
The way he's like, I'm not an alcoholic, is like, sir, I don't think you understand the concept of a high functioning alcoholic. Because it's like, I can tell you the interesting thing, we're talking about him in 1980, and I think in 1980 is also when he really realizes that, like, Peter O'Toole can play Peter O'Toole. You know,
and
some of his great roles are that, like some of these Oscar nominations we're going to talk about are that. But like at the same time, he was not really in a ton of 70s movies, partially because he had stomach cancer that went on for way too long because they just thought it was cirrhosis. They just thought he was such an alcoholic that they didn't realize he had cancer. So like he had to have in 76, he had his pancreas and a large part of his stomach removed. And then he had to get diabetes because he lost so many guts. And then he also in 78 had a like severe blood disorder due to alcoholism. So like 80 is really him coming back to being healthy enough to work. Like he took like 4 years off to recover. So like whether or not what he did was fueled by the drinking, like the drinking severely affected his life at this point in his career.
I just think it's so interesting some of the stuff he would do. Like, he got kicked out of Italy because he was with a woman there who was an Italian starlet. I don't remember who, I'm sorry. Sure. And he, the paparazzi was getting really, like, pushy with them. So he punched one of the paparazzi in the face and broke his camera, like you
sure.
do.
Classic.
And then, exactly. And then he was arrested and they kind of released him to his own recognizance.
Yeah.
That's the one, recognizance. So that he would be, but they said, don't leave because you're going to end up in prison here, but we're watching you. So he sent his stunt double to check out while he escaped on like a train to the next like country over and then disappeared and then tried to get Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor and like a bunch of other big name actors to boycott filming in Italy. So that because they're like, geez. They did this to me. Like it's fascinating. But my favorite story, I think, is that he apparently had a long-term on and off affair with Elizabeth Taylor. And at one point he got into a huge drunken argument with Richard Burton on who was the better actor. And then it finally culminated with, I have been boffing your wife for years. Why don't we ask her? It's just like, wow. So yeah, just like, again, I think like his performances are really powerful and they're very riveting. And like, he's got those blue eyes that like, it's like Paul Newman yeah. or Frank Sinatra. Like you can't kind of look away from them. They're magnetic. He's just so, he brings so much of that like threat of mania and violence to his role that like you don't sure. it's an unpredictability yeah. that's I think what makes him compelling to watch.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing is like I say with the like high functioning alcoholism, you never really hear about him being too much of a terror on set. Like he always completed his movie. It was like, you know, how Dennis Hopper was being nominated for Oscars in the depths of his addiction. Like I think that there's something to be said for that you can be. Or you hear about all these actors, like we say, especially in this era, who...
Do we still have actors like this, though?
Oh, yeah. Are you asking if you still have actors who are addicts?
Yeah.
No, but like who have those sort of antics, but are still functioning on the level where they're being nominated for Oscars and are able to
work
at this level.
Well, I think, you know, the Disneyfication, yeah. you kind of hide the antics a bit more, but...
It's harder to hide those antics with social media and with paparazzi. I mean, we've always had paparazzi, but with, you know, people taking cell phone videos of Nicolas Cage, hate to bring him up, in what was it, a buffet last week? I can't remember what he got kicked out of without shoes on, but it wasn't good.
Kiefer Sutherland, I mean, God bless him. I think he's sober now, but when he jumped on that Christmas tree, it was pretty great.
Yeah.
That's right. When he was a pirate.
Yeah,
yes.
And again, he never stopped working.
No. And he works at a fairly high level.
Yeah,
so, Cam,
I
totally
agree
with that.
And I think it's part of his mystique. I think that Kiefer Sutherland's a bit of a bad boy is part of his deal.
I do have to say that my social anxiety disorder, whenever I go to industry parties, the only way I'm able to get through them is I tell myself, as long as I don't throw up on Kiefer Sutherland, I am okay. So if I ever go to a party where Kiefer Sutherland is actually in attendance, I have to leave immediately.
But again, if any gentleman would probably be understanding of being barfed on a little, it's probably Mr.
it's
Sutherland.
Probably Kiefer Sutherland. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into our first movie of the day. So although O'Toole never won an Oscar, not even a final farewell for the movie Venus when he was 71, he was nominated 8 times, including for our first movie today, where he gives a performance Ebert described as so very arch and fey that we realize no one like this could really exist except possibly in real life. Now, The Stuntman was released in 1980, but it's a movie that feels like it has its roots in a similar time as many of the movies critical of Hollywood in the mid to late 70s. And there's a reason for that. Cam, how tall was King Kong?
I mean, I don't understand that statement, but I love it in the film.
3'6".
Thank you, Alicia. That's what I was waiting for.
I mean, that's good to know. Actually bigger than you would assume. this movie is interesting because, it was developed through most of the 70s. The director, Richard Rush, had his big hit in 1970 even, and this was kind of his, like, he had Freebie and the Bean in between, but he was working towards this film the entire time. It was meant to be his follow-up. So it's interesting that it takes this long to come out. The Stuntman is a very weird movie. Well, Richard
Real
Rush
weird.
Is a weird director, really loves kind of mixed tones in a way that's part of why this took so long to make, is it has no real set tone. It's like a thriller that's a comedy that's a romance. It's about this guy, Cameron is all you ever get the name of him, played by Steve Railsback, who is on the run from the law for unknown reasons at the start of the film. And he accidentally stumbles into a stunt shot of a movie. And his intervention potentially or potentially not kills the stuntman. And then when the police kind of converge on this set eventually, Peter O'Toole, who's the director of the film, who has seen this accident and filmed it, decides to lie to the police and say that he is the stuntman. That oh no, the stuntman survived, it's fine, here he is.
Bert.
Yes. So now
his name is Bert.
This guy Cameron, who has no real experience in any film industry or stunts or anything, he's an old soldier from Vietnam,
which he reminds you repeatedly,
yes. And he seems like that war broke him mentally.
That is correct.
Is thrown into the world of reality and illusions that is cinema, and Peter O'Toole, as Eli Cross, this director, is essentially constantly manipulating him, sometimes for positive ways, sometimes for negative ways, as he like tries to get different performances and stunts out of him throughout the film. And that's kind of what it is. Eli Cross really wants to know the crime he committed, which is part of his motivation, but he also is motivated to try to make the best anti-war film ever, which is kind of yeah. And in the middle of all this is Barbara Hershey too, who is the star of the film and he's falling in love with.
I know Peter O'Toole based his performance of Eli Cross, the director, and this is like, it's so theatrical, but he based on David Lean, mm-hmm. which I really love, to come back to Lawrence of Arabia, of course, the director of Lawrence of Arabia and other similar masterpieces. And I just love knowing that, you know, there's these great sequences where O'Toole's character is on one of those chairs that's on a crane. And he's
yes,
just like
the crane chair
zipping around like he's Willy Wonka. And knowing that's, you know, wearing a long scarf, which David Lean always did, I believe. Maybe that's not true. I might be picturing T.H. Lawrence. I'm not sure. But I just love those scenes of him. Like the characters will think they have privacy and then he just zips in on a crane chair.
Which
and
is
like,
nonsense,
with a megaphone.
You would see that thing a mile away.
You would hear it.
Yeah.
Because it's not like its own little gyrocopter.
No,
you know what
but
I mean?
But they make it so quiet and great in that regard.
It's effective. I mean, it's not plausible, but it's actually quite effective that as director, as the person, mm-hmm. you know, in a tourist world, I feel like it sounds like I said a tourist world, but I said a tourist. That the director is the center of everything and no one else on a set matters. Like, they're really, really going for that. And the idea of this, you know, Richard Rush, the director of this film, making up this meta film about a very famous star as a director playing another famous real life director. Like, there's so many different layers. And then you add in the fact that there's a lot of actors in this who are real stuntmen. And I don't know, Becky, did you notice Whitey in it?
I saw Convoy? Whitey. Okay. Did I ever? Yeah.
Talked about him a long time ago. Yeah, there's a lot of like just little shots of people who were real industry stunt people, some of the most famous stunt people in Hollywood. And they get to kind of have a nice moment where they're in front of the camera and meant to be seen in front of the camera and meant to be themselves and not a double for a different performer.
I thought I might have seen Dar Robinson for a second, but I looked it up and he's not in this either. Okay. And we're going to talk about Dar Robinson at some point in the podcast because I love him.
But yeah, it's
he might be in it, but not credited.
Yeah, exactly. That's also the weird thing. And I mean, it's an interesting when we talk about Richard Rush and like what drew him to this. This is based on a novel by Paul Brodeur, and it was given to him, and he kind of doesn't love the novel. And I actually have had a tough time figuring out the plot of the novel because I don't know how much it has to do with the final film. But all Richard Rush cared about was that idea of like, this is a weird mishmash of reality and illusions, and I can get as meta as I want with that. And that's what drew him to kind of like redoing the script in his mind. And he also like, he makes no bones about that the director character is also like his dream of a director. Like, of course your dream is to manipulate people into the best performance ever. Yeah. You just ethically can't do it. But he did do it a few times, which I love. You hear about Peter O'Toole says some of those helicopter scenes. He was purposefully screwing with O'Toole. And I think one of the times where Peter O'Toole scoops up Steve Railsback, they didn't tell him how it was going to happen. They just had Peter O'Toole. They figured out they could come up behind
him
with the crane.
The,
yeah, one of the scoop ups.
Aforementioned chair.
And yes, like, and just drags him into the sky. And one of those scoop ups, they did not tell Steve Railsback that's what's happening. Peter O'Toole just literally scooped him up into the sky. So sometimes he did do crazy Eli Cross moves, which is kind of fascinating.
You don't really trust me, do you? Come here to me. You constantly amaze me. You don't go to movies. What are you, a communist?
I think my favorite thing is that he referred to it as Richard testing his pucker, which held, but only just.
Oh my God.
I'm like, oh,
yes,
boy.
Yes. I don't know.
I really loved the opening for this film, and I can't remember which film critic it was. It might have actually been Pauline Kael, who described it as like a Rube Goldberg-esque opening credit sequence.
Yes.
And it goes on and on and on. And it's just almost like Pee-wee Herman's Big Adventure, mm-hmm. Pee-wee's Big Adventure, sorry, where you with the breakfast making machine. That's happening on a much larger scale with this film that's trying to capture all these stunts where like a bird will drop an egg and the egg will fall in someone's pocket and then that person starts walking and that person encounters a rake and then the rake sets off. It's like a domino effect. And I didn't love this film. I think that I find it very interesting. I'm really glad we're talking about it because it's undervalued. I didn't love it, but I will say I loved that opening sequence. Like to me, if I was curating a collection of best opening sequences in cinema,
apparently Richard Rush also says that's his like signature. He says all his major movies, because he's a guy who mostly did exploitation movies and like weird cheap movies, and I think he thought that was just a fun way to set up the scene of like this is kind of the tone of the movie in a bunch of unrelated little vignettes.
I know he did Freebie and the Bean before this, and I've been kind of dying to see that. Cam, you and I have talked about this. Have you seen Freebie and the Bean?
Yes, I have.
It's brutal, right? Like it's really
no. It's
racist.
It's good. It's a little 70s. Definitely, some of it hasn't aged that well. But it like kind of invents the buddy cop genre in a lot of ways. Like a lot of people think Lethal Weapon and stuff is based pretty clearly on it.
And so, does that film have a Rube Goldberg?
I can't remember. Him saying that kind of fascinates me because I honestly, it would.
This is why I'm asking because I'm like curious about that.
Like that, the tone of that is very Freebie and the Bean. So I absolutely believe if any movie has it, it's Freebie and the Bean. The interesting thing is that his other big movie, Getting Straight, is kind of like this counterculture movie that was very big. Like it was a movie that like Francois Truffaut loved. So I'm like, does that have a weird Rube Goldberg opening? Because that would be very interesting. I haven't seen that one.
I don't direct films. I think our listeners are aware of that. But if I did, I can tell you right now, I would open every film with a Rube Goldberg. In fact, I would say my idea for a screenplay is one film entirely Rube Goldberg. Just the opening sequence. Everything that happens in the film is somehow a Rube
that
Goldberg.
That movie is called Slacker, Alicia.
I mean, that's pretty much like Baby's Day Out, I guess. There's movies like that.
Yeah. It's all true. Yeah. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, no, Slacker's like that too. Richard Linklater's Slacker is
yeah, I guess
next,
that's
next,
everything.
Next.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway, it's a very interesting thing, and I think it's a real exploitation idea. And you do see like the stuntman who is in this film as the stunt expert, Charles Bale, sometimes Chuck Bale, is his actual stunt coordinator since the start of his exploitation days. So you know stuff like that is also just like these are the things these guys come up with because they've worked together this whole time. And I think he if I'm remembering correctly, he also worked a lot with Laszlo Kovac. And established a lot of weird camera tricks, which is kind of fascinating, like rack focusing and stuff they worked on together in 35mm. So it's like this fascinating thing where this guy had a bunch of tricks that was really what made his career, is these kind of like, and that's I think what this movie is, why it's memorable, is there's all these weird, I mean, number one, crazy stunts throughout, number two, weird kind of touches that you would usually find in an exploitation film.
I think you mentioned that this has a very strange tonal shift thing happening all over the place. And I was with you with that as I was watching this. I'm like, what is that? Like, how am I supposed to feel about any of these characters? Because I'm laughing at them, but now I'm horrified by the behavior. But now, like, what is going on? And apparently audiences had the same issue. And Rush was, like, trying to rewrite things because he was like, people are laughing in places they aren't laughing, and I thought, or they weren't supposed to be laughing, and I thought this part was dramatic, but people are laughing. What is this? So it almost feels like he himself didn't totally know what the tone was.
If I may, and I don't like to blame people, but the lead actor, the stuntman, is terrible.
He's interesting, yeah.
And I think a lot of the laughter is because sometimes what he's conveying as an emotion in this film doesn't match what's actually in the screenplay.
I'm beginning to feel like something Sam wrote. I'm not real. I'm some jerk American flyer from World War I who's got to go off a bridge and die because some goddamn script says so.
I think physically he works in this film beautifully, and like the many, many stunt sequences that he performs in.
He
great.
Like, also comes off as unhinged.
So I will say the unhinged he did want, because he cast him because he famously played Charles Manson in Helter Skelter on TV.
Yes.
So, and that's why he wanted him. So I think the thing that's weird is that sometimes they're putting this guy in fairly gentle situations. Like, what he wanted was the maniac. That is kind of, you never know if he's going to do something bad.
Yeah.
I think the chemistry between him and Barbara Hershey isn't quite there. And I think, well, she's an actress I really appreciate and I've liked in a lot of other things. And she's okay in this. It would have been such a different film if they'd gotten someone that was more in the Hollywood glamour vein. Because she's supposed to be this glamorous kind of, you know, she does impressions of Greta Garbo, for instance, in this film. And, like, it just doesn't work with Barbara Hershey because she's so modern and she's so... naturalistic.
Well, when she does the reveal, because again, this movie is all about illusion, she does the reveal where she goes from being this old woman into this beautiful young woman. It's, you can see with the makeup that she's, I mean, Barbara Hershey's a beautiful woman, but she's not like a glamour girl. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a weird, it's a transition that doesn't work.
It doesn't translate. And so much of the importance of this film's narrative is around the fact that the director, Eli Cross, played by Peter O'Toole, has had a previous sexual relationship with her when she was an up and coming actress, and that actually doesn't go in the creepy direction you think it's going to go in, which I liked, but it just, they have no chemistry either, so then it's just like, it's just there's a lack of chemistry here, but an incredible technological prowess with the props. It's just, the only person really mesmerizing this film is Peter.
Well, and that's why he got nominated for the Oscar. Although Alicia and I were discussing this, is that we have a feeling this was another, like, toss the bone to Peter and see if he can win this one.
I don't know. People really love this movie. Yeah. It's very well reviewed.
Here's the weird thing I am finding is that when I was going, like, I like to read a lot of contemporary reviews of these older movies, to, or like current reviews of these older movies to see if they still hold up and if they still have champions. And what's so weird is people who love this movie seem to compare it to Ordinary People and are very adamant that Ordinary People is bad and this is great.
I mean, it was the Best Picture winner that year is probably why.
Understandably.
Every film that wins Best Picture gets that for about 20 years, right? Okay. Where we all say it's a piece of crap and it never should have won. We're now back on, you know, it's been 25 years and, like, thank God Titanic is a masterpiece today. Because in 2002, it was not. But, yeah, I feel like any sort of Ordinary People backlash, which is, I'm sorry, absolutely misplaced. That's a masterpiece of a film.
Yeah.
But comparing it to this, and I understand why people love this. Mm. I understand. If anyone told me that this is one of their favorite films, I'd be like, damn, that's a cool choice. Like, I support you in your path.
I respect your iconoclast journey. Yes.
to your stuntman glory. It's just, there's just some things that I find distracting. Yeah.
It's worth saying that also he got, it's not just Peter O'Toole nomination. There was also a nomination for Richard Rush and the screenplay. And it was nominated for Best Picture a lot of places.
I think reasonably so. Mm-hmm. Like, the screenplay is really interesting.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. There's an interesting idea in here. And as Pauline Kael, who was like the big champion of this, that got the movie kind of respected critically, according to Peter O'Toole, he said that this almost wasn't released. Like, it was a movie without a release. They just totally botched this. So it didn't do well commercially. But critics, as you mentioned, love this. Because I think there is something really cool about this idea of, like, what's happening, what's not. And you'd kind of see something like that with another movie we're going to be talking about later, The Game, where you don't quite know what's happening. It just keeps twisting.
Yeah.
But this is a cinematic version of that, which I think could be really
cool. That's where I do think that the weird tone works, because towards the end, essentially both of the guys have seemed to lost their mind. And in the end, you know that essentially Peter O'Toole was being very carefully manipulative. But the fact that the other guy has lost his mind, you don't know how crazy he's going to be to Peter O'Toole. And that creates a pretty good tension.
So there's
a real, like, there's a real scary climax to this film. And I don't want to spoil it because I think a lot of our listeners maybe haven't seen this film and will go out and watch it, as they should. But I was freaking out. My heart was pounding. I was like, oh my God, please don't go here, film. Please don't go here. And I won't say if it did or not, but I really found that impressive.
And there's kind of like 8 twists in that part too, where you're like, oh, they did this. Oh, is this happening? Oh, is this happening? And if anything, they don't earn the kind of, like, the ending where they're all like, ha ha, now we're all friends. It's like,
But is it also kind of weird that they're treating this stuntman like he's the leading man? Like, you never
see
the leading man
that
do any
is
actors.
Odd. I actually, like, I was like, did I look away and the leading man, like, died? but no, I mean, it's it's interesting. And I guess it's that's supposed to be that Eli sees something else in him. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of suspension of disbelief, as you said, because I think you said, Becky, like a lot of times it's like, where am I even looking? Like the camera is always in a weird place because you're seeing eight cameras. And I mean, that's apparently Chuck Bale did a lot of second unit work as well, which is kind of fascinating. He's like an actor. He was secretly stunt coordinating a bit. He's the second unit director. It's kind of wild.
Well, there's this one segment that I think was my favorite part where, like, they're filming part of the film where, like, he's on top of a roof and he's being attacked. This is a World War I drama. He's on top of a roof and he's being attacked. And then, like, there's guns. And then he falls down the roof. And then he has to battle a bunch of people. And then he falls through again. And he's now, like, on top. He's in a brothel. And, you know, and then he has. And you're like, where is the camera in this single shot?
Running, I suppose. Yeah, I don't know.
I suppose so. But, like, the sequence itself is actually really cool that it was shot. It's just the fact that you don't see the camera operators, which is kind of what I wanted to see. I want to see where the cameras are if this is a movie within a movie, right?
Yeah, I guess in the day, maybe if you did a stunt that elaborate, you would have 9 or 10 cameras set up.
Oh, I'm sure.
They also kind of, I think, throughout imply that Peter O'Toole has essentially godlike powers, because there's even a time where he gets rushes so quickly that the guy's like, how did he get the rushes?
Is it because he's flying?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, he literally flies in and out.
The poster is him being like a little devil on the chair, you know? So, yeah, I think that there's kind of some weird magic realist implications almost, too.
I want that crane chair. That is the only way I shall be transported from here.
I mean, the weird thing is, too, it's like, that's a very specific piece of equipment that is not used that much in any given film, unless you were like flying around doing establishing shots all the time. It's just a fascinating time for a lot of these people, I guess, because Peter O'Toole is kind of having a comeback. This really predates Barbara Hershey. We didn't touch on it very much, but she started when she was like 16, which I did not know. But throughout the 70s, she was kind of a joke because she was David Carradine's girlfriend, and I guess they were kind of a tabloid fodder.
And then with The Entity, I'm sure, was like not great for her career. Is that after? Okay, still.
Any role you know for her is after. And I actually think The Entity did well for her career. I think people like that role.
Interesting.
It's a weird movie, don't get me wrong.
But
she acts well. But yeah, and then so the other thing that I mean fascinated me digging into it is so she was a butt of a joke for a long time in the 1970s because she was on set and something about her acting killed a seagull. And in tribute, she changed her name to Barbara Siegel. And everyone made fun of her for like horribly.
Barbara Hershey.
And only when she broke up with Carradine, who was kind of overshadowing her career and mounted this new comeback, she changed her name back to Hershey and was taken seriously once more. Yeah, so it's this kind of weird time in her career because I never knew she was like a teen actor, essentially. Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting. And yeah, it's a weird movie. Like you say, obviously, it was barely distributed. Fox only picked it up after it won the Montreal and Dallas Film Festival. So it's like very strange. And Richard Rush, I recommend listening to. He's a very tanned man with tinted sunglasses. It's just what you want out of this movie.
But because of the tone, I can see people looking at this and going, how do we market this? Like, what is this? And it does feel like a movie from the mid 70s. It doesn't feel like something from the 1980s. Because we're now in 1980. It's very much a transitional year. We're going to be talking about some movies that are like, oh, this is an 80s movie. It has this level of camera work and this kind of style and sophistication of topics that you don't have in 70s movies. And that's what this feels like.
And I mean, that's the interesting thing is part of why it lost all its stuff is he stuck to his guns with his script and people didn't like it. And then for a while, William Castle was producing it. And so it kind of just bounced around outside of studios.
Would in the theater there have been a crane chair descend from the ceiling at one point?
I mean, maybe.
With an actor?
I don't know. By this point, William Castle had produced Rosemary's Baby, so I think he was a little classier. But yeah, and the interesting thing to know is, like, in the end, it was super beloved in Europe. And that's there's a good quote where people ask Francois Truffaut who his favorite director is, and he just goes, "Who directed The Stuntman?" I love that movie. And,
I think the only other actor to really like embody and sit on that like moving chair throne
better is Kermit in the Muppet movie. Sure. That's the only time I've ever seen that depicted in film, where he's like, where he swoops in and it like tears down the set or something like that. It ruins the whole film at the end.
I think it's also telling that we haven't even mentioned that there's a cop trying to figure everything out, gosh, and get the amount of talent. Like, there's a bunch of plot lines that don't really matter because of the antics. It's a weird little movie. But again, I think we're all recommending it as a, like, watch this one at least once because it's fascinating.
Mm. Yes.
Beautiful. All right. So when we come back, we're going to look at a movie that none of us can figure out why it wasn't an enormous hit at the time. And also, it's got Kurt Russell. And boy, do we love Kurt Russell. That's coming up after the break.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
We've discussed Zemeckis and Gale movies twice in season one of the podcast, and if there's one thing we know for sure about their work, they love car stunts. So if you've ever wanted to watch Kurt Russell leapfrog from one to another of 250 speeding cars in the middle of the desert, boy, do I have a movie to sell you. Critic Pauline Kael called it an American tall tale movie in a pop art form. It's the movie right before the Two Bobs went nuclear famous with back-to-back hits for basically the remainder of the 80s and early 90s. Used cars. Let's go, Alicia.
Yeah, it's got a lot in common with Weekend at Bernie's, which I had forgotten upon third viewing. Used Cars is about two rival used car dealerships that are across the highway from each other in Mesa, Arizona. One is quite well-to-do and run by an evil man played by Jack Warden, and the other one is run by another character played by Jack Warden because they are twin brothers, and this other car dealership is pretty ramshackle. A lot of the bumpers are stuck on with bubble gum, which is a joke that doesn't quite land. I still think this film's very funny, but that joke doesn't land at all. And it's just, you know, they have like just nothing but jalopies. The film introduces our lead character, Kurt Russell, who works for the poorly car dealership, and he's like got a drill and is running it backwards to make the odometer go down on the cars, which I don't think you could ever actually have done.
It doesn't work. No,
I think
that's not a thing.
Because when I was little, I grew up on Matilda, and so of course Danny DeVito's car dealership character does that, and I think it's an homage to this film. But no, it was not possible. My parents told me you couldn't actually do that. I could be wrong, but the brother, the evil brother, wants to take over this other dealership because there's going to be a highway that's going to be built, and only he really knows it through corruption. And if he can get the land, then that means he'll have the most powerful car dealership. So he ostensibly murders his brother in a roundabout way. It's very funny. He doesn't actually murder him, but they take him on a very haphazard test drive, and they know he has a heart condition, and he dies. And so Kurt Russell, knowing that they'll lose the dealership if it's ever found out that his boss is dead, buries him in a car and fills it in with cement, and then pretends, like it's Weekend at Bernie's, that he's still alive. His daughter, the car dealership's daughter, shows up. She's been in a cult for a few years in California. Mm-hmm. And so she hasn't seen her dad. She doesn't know he's dead for most of the film. And so she's going to inherit the car lot. That's part of the story. There's a lot of hijinks. Kurt Russell falls in love with her. And at a certain point, when she has the car dealership, she does this commercial. And the rival car dealership re-edits it. So it sounds like she's saying she has a mile of cars on the dealership. Now they can then sue her from the consumer standpoint of that she's misrepresenting the dealership on television.
See, the a mile of cars we have to choose from.
It is wild to me that the high tension point of this movie is about FCC legalities and technicalities.
Yeah. But this is just what happened.
The whole thing is that the guy seems to have the consumer protection person in his pocket. Yes. Joe Flaherty,
which apparently was supposed to be John Candy, but he was busy doing 1941. And as much as I want them to use SCTV actors, I would like them to have given them more to do.
Yeah, that's fair. But at a certain point, they then have to find a way. And a mile of cars equals 250 to 300 cars. They have to find a way to get 300 cars within an hour on this dealership so that she won't go to jail for perjury, because she said yes, that she has a mile of cars, and the FCC can't take the dealership away from them and give it to the evil brother who is still living. There's a lot of stunts in this. There's a lot of silliness. To characterize the kind of character that Kurt Russell plays, he's the type of man who would take a date to a bowling alley because they have the best salad bar in town. It did not look good, that salad bar. And Garrett Graham is in this. For fans of Phantom of the Paradise, Garrett Graham, of course, is Beef in that film. He's got a really big role in this, and he doesn't have a ton of large roles, so I really enjoyed this film for that. I liked this film upon first viewing, which is why we kind of thought of it for the podcast. And then I have to say, I got way more into it seeing it the second time. I think it needs multiple viewings. This will be on Hollywood Suite, so you can watch it to your heart's content on demand. It is really funny. It's full of wackiness. Not all of it lands, but what does land is pretty hilarious. And it's a real cult hit because this was a huge failure. Really almost ruined, I would say, Galen Zemeckis. And is now kind of really up there. It has a recent restoration from Shout Factory. It's really up there with the pinnacle of black comedies and cult status.
Well, this almost ruined them at the same time as they penned the script for 1941, which was Spielberg's first enormous flop, right? So that two back-to-back was not happening. And then Romance in the Stone had already been greenlit, and that's what just made them go.
And Spielberg produces this film.
That is correct.
And I think this is the second Amblin film in existence. And I think you see the Spielberg influence. It's rated R, which they had not done a rated R film before. Mm-hmm. And it's raunchy. There's definitely some...
Because there's boobs.
There's a lot of female
nudity. But also
nudity.
The amount Jack Warden swears is apparently... very appealing to him.
Yeah,
he had not really sworn in a film before.
Yeah, it's this is the same year. If anything, this actually came out the same summer as Airplane, as Blues Brothers. This was quite an iconic. The summer of 1980 was quite an iconic time for comedy, and I think it did really, really well at a test screening. And the Columbia, which is the distributor, the producers, they rushed it, and it came out the week after Airplane, when Airplane was going to be number one for months and months, and it just sank, unfortunately, which is really unfortunate, because we get sort of the makings of Kurt Russell's stardom, that comedic stardom that he's, this is 2 years before The Thing, this is before
and it's the first time you see him be an asshole.
Yeah.
That he can be that charming
dick
in a suit.
Yes, and still be charming and come about face and be sort of vindicated. And he just works well in this. It's funny though, because I know there was a commentary he recorded for this film quite a while ago. And he's always the best person on a bonus commentary on DVDs or Blu-rays. And he was like, you know what would have made this film a lot better? If it was Bill Murray starring in it and not me.
I mean, it's very weird. If you do know this is partially based, the other producer is John Milius. Mm-hmm. And his original idea, they were obsessed with getting George Hamilton for the role.
That would have been wrong. That wouldn't have worked.
But George Hamilton turned it down. How about that? Wow. George Hamilton did not want to do this script. And yeah, it's very weird. Kurt Russell, it's kind of too soon. He did Elvis before, but he wasn't really doing that. And yeah, before it's essentially the Disneyland shows on TV. And then he had this long running show called The Quest, where he plays essentially he's a white man raised by the Cheyenne. So he kind of talks like Tonto and is a very stoic, Mr. Spock type character. So it's this is so different.
He was so recognizable as a child star. Mm-hmm. I think we forget that about Kurt Russell, that through his work with Disney, he was in some really high profile Disney television works, and then also film works. If you go on Disney Plus, I think some of those are on there.
Mm-hmm. And Peter wore tennis shoes and whatnot.
And so obviously him, and he's such an interesting child actor who transitioned in a big way. I can't think of many comparisons to him.
I mean, Jodie Foster is kind of like one of the few people like that. But Zemeckis actually cast Russell because of his Disney history, because he was like, we wanted a Jimmy Stewart who could commit atrocities and still be like.
And you also like some of it's based on his fame, because he is, I think, arguably way too young for this role. He's 27. Yeah. It's kind of a little odd, but it works because Kurt Russell just looks the same age, kind of. So you're like, yeah, he could be 35, but it's like, no, he's still a kid.
Yeah. And I love that this is set in Arizona. Like, it's just, my understanding is setting it in a real car dealership that operated. It was a Darner Chrysler Plymouth of Mesa, which existed until 10 years ago. And when Chrysler went bankrupt, they lost the dealership. But it gives such an authenticity to the feel of this film, because it's really set in a town that is on like the fringes, and just, it's not Los Angeles, it's dry. When this car stunt that we're talking about, so he ends up being able to buy 250 cars from his Mexican car dealer friend, who is
can we point out, this is Alfonso Arau, who would go on to direct like Waterford Chocolate,
can winning director Alfonso Arau in a comedic performance, sells him 250 junker cars, and then he gets the driving school like high school students to drive them all across the desert.
It's a great moment.
It's so great. And it's really, if you think about it, it's really like Red River, the classic Western, where there's this very complicated cattle drive. That's the climax of that film, with, I want to say, thousands of cows. I'm not sure how many there actually were in the 40s. But it really is kind of, you know, it's hearkening back to those great cattle drive films
Yeah, I can see what you're saying.
I'm there with you.
Yep. It's not too much of a stretch.
Thank you.
I also want to go back and say, great thing about the fact that they were using a real dealership is you can go on YouTube and look up Kurt Russell cut a series of commercials for Darner Plymouth, where he's like, I'm Kurt Russell. Come on down to
Which
Darner
he
Plymouth.
He didn't have to do contractually. He did it
he did it for fun.
Out of kindness. And I think that was probably a really big deal for that car dealership. Becky, you and I were talking about this because we worked a bit together in person for the first time in a long time while filming.
Which is wonderful. Humans.
Yeah,
yes.
Humans. And we were saying that, you know, it's really hard to take a stance or a bet on anyone turning out to be a good person, because like almost any star that you love, there will be a story that will come out and you'll be like, well, that person's ruined for me. But if there was like a roulette wheel and there was like all these photos of actors and I had to like put my chip on one and it, like I was betting my whole life, the only person I would bet on is Kurt Russell, I'm pretty sure.
Ooh, I'm sorry.
No!
he just famously doesn't talk politics, which I think in this day and age is a bit of a red flag, I gotta say.
But wait a minute, there's nothing he said, though. Like, if
and there's no stories.
He will stop. He will be like, I do not talk politics.
And to you, that indicates he might be like a Trump supporter?
Oh, yeah. I think it means that you're a right-wing person, for sure.
Well, I want to end this podcast right now.
Sorry. Listen, and I mean, maybe he's just, maybe it's just an old school thing. But
that's a possibility. You know what? He's been in the industry long enough that he knows whatever he says.
But it's also,
he's
old enough and his career is past enough that I think you should be able to talk about.
He can't be that conservative because he's, A, not married to Goldie Hawn. They're still living in sin. Like, and he's best friends with Martin Short.
He says that stars who talk politics hurt the craft of acting.
Stars who say stupid shit hurt the craft of acting, for sure.
No, I mean, I don't know. So it's a
Cam,
little...
You're leaning me.
It's not great. Okay. He's also been a rich guy for a long time, and they all eventually turn that way. Fine. And again, he has done nothing bad. I see nothing bad. He seems to have raised nice kids who love him. Everybody likes him.
Just seeing some mild red flags.
I think my bet would still stand then. Because, like, if you have nothing to, like... you know, move my chip, then I still think I would win that bet.
I mean, I just think that nowadays a 70-year-old saying they don't talk politics is like, all right, buddy.
He said that
this year. Yeah. This year. Not like that this is... Yeah. He was saying, I think, maybe a little... And depending on the timing, if he said that around Black Lives Matter, that sucks.
All right. No, I agree. Now, I think that this is one of those movies where, like, I laughed at a number of points. I thought the stunts were really impressive. I want to see it remade, and I want certain elements to be updated, because I think it's pretty well known that for large portions of their career, Gale and Zemeckis did not care about or were not good at writing female characters.
Yeah.
And so you don't have a building. It's wild to me that I Want to Hold Your Hand exists and is as good as it is.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, like, except for I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Exactly, which is just wild.
Yeah. But
like in general, that tends to be the case. And this, I think, is this movie's biggest flaw. And even people who support it are like, this is an issue.
There's also, I think, something weird. It strikes me that part of this movie was cut out. Because it's not that her character isn't well developed, it's that her character literally disappears for like a whole
large
act
chunk
of the movie.
And like you don't actually get the idea she's taken it back from him. Like there's nothing in there.
It's weird. Like so Deborah Harmon shows up as this daughter, and she actually has a very interesting turn where there is the moment where she knows her dad is dead, and it's like the same time. She essentially knows her dad is dead, knows these guys have covered it up. Gets the pretty much immediate impression. I think she knows that the things are so bad between the twins that it probably is the guy's fault he killed them. And she has to make the choice of whether she turns them in or keeps the dealership. And she chooses to lie along with these guys. But yeah, there's this whole interesting aspect to her character that would be that maybe she doesn't lie and she is learning to be one of these slick operators like these guys, and that's where she is by the end of it. But you miss that whole
but
chunk.
That's what I want. I actually wish there wasn't a romance plot line at all. I wish it's just like it's her getting into bed with him, but like business wise in cahoots.
That's what I want it to be.
Any
of the romance that works is because Kurt Russell's not really trying to romance her at all.
Yeah.
He's just romancing her because it's the way to get what he wants. And that date is very funny because, he's just like, he's trying to keep her away and not to watch the ads. And
but I think anytime this movie is really succeeding, it's because there is some significantly complex shoot of like hijinks. And you don't see movies with hijinks very often. And so the bit where Garrett is going through with all of the bad luck and like he's trying to decrease his luck so he loses this bet so that Kurt Russell can win a whole bunch of money in this gambling thing.
Because he wants
to
run for Congress.
Will win.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because he wants to get bribes. He needs to
get
money for a bribe so he can then for the rest of his life get bribes.
I do get what some critics said, that this is convoluted. Ebert said it was a little too convoluted.
Oh, yes.
But there's other critics, like I think Pauline Kael, again, name comes up all the time on the podcast, including this episode. She's the one that was like, this is a W.C. Fields like spoof.
Yeah.
And it is. And those are the elements that work for me so well. I don't know, Becky, I think you need to like sit on it for 6 months and watch it again.
And go back again. Yeah. Okay.
With a bottle of wine like I did last night.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, the biggest thing I can't get over is when the woman's, they're doing the live commercial and the woman's dress gets torn off and she's visibly distressed, and that part really bothers me.
But is that worse
I know
than
it is.
Anything
it
in 1980, like the Blues Brothers or even like elements of Airplane?
I am willing to forgive 30s and 40s screwball comedy, so I just got to be like, you know what, if I like the rest of the movie,
we were talking about how egregious it is at work, and I'm like, that woman could have done a better job covering her butt. Her distress kind of doesn't work because she does nothing to cover her nudity.
From her nude is we then are taken to a living room where a family of like ostensibly 12 children all under the age of 6 are watching it live on TV while the dad's eyes are like bulging out of his head and the mom is screaming, and it's like that's the kind of payoff I think you get in that scene.
And please, the kid goes, look, Dad, bare tits.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
So good. I mean, yeah, so the interesting thing to me is, like, I agree that there's these great comic set pieces, but there's just kind of, like, too much road between them.
Agreed.
It's a long movie.
It's
if you compare it to Airplane, that's the problem. Is like, Airplane is just gag. And it's inventing that. But yeah, there's something here. And I mean, the other thing that's weird, I think you can't really blame Gale and Zemeckis because they were very work for hire. This was very like Milius and Spielberg had an idea and they're like, yeah, we'll do it, because they were kind of hurting and they didn't know they would be hurting even worse after 1941 flopped so hard. But the other interesting thing is apparently they did this movie partially because they were trying to make Looters, aka Trespass, and nobody really wanted it at the moment. So they went back to it. But I mean, I love the broad stuff. I mean, the part where like David Lander and Michael McKean are in it, Lenny and Scorsese, and when he's like, "You can do this," and he's like, "If I can make this man a pacemaker," and Michael McKean has like a homemade
like
pacemaker
staples in his chest.
Yeah, and it's like that is wackier than almost anything we see in the movie.
And Michael McKean looks so proud of it. Like, check it out.
And it's like an infected.
I know.
Bunch of
I know that you. Universal, because of course Steven Spielberg had a very intimate relationship with Universal, and Universal passed on this. They hated the script. Mm-hmm. And the only reason it really got made is, and got made at Columbia, was that the studio head of Columbia at this time was a former car dealership, like, salesperson.
Yeah, an actual used car salesman.
And really liked the idea that he could maybe consult and lend an air of authenticity on selling used cars. And I'm like, that's actually magical. That is really lovely.
I don't know. And I think that the thing that, like, it makes sense. Like, I'm surprised anyone passed on it, because it's like, if you look at the top grossing comedies of the 70s, it's like, Grease is kind of the weird standout. It made $1 million. It's not really a comedy, but it's still cars. But there's like The Sting, Smokey and the Bandit, Every Which Way But Loose, and like Heaven Can Wait. Like, Heaven Can Wait has Jack Warden. These are all...
Oh, yeah.
It's interesting. It's really of a piece of those movies, and half of those movies are car stunts and car racing, which is this movie. And this year, I think you get Any Which Way You Can and Smoking the Bandit 2, as well as, like, yeah, it's weird. And it's also, like, this is actually a little early for R-rated comedy. Like, that's more of the 80s thing. Not that there weren't a lot of adult comedies, obviously, in the 70s, but yeah, I don't know.
I'm
it's weird.
With you that this does feel like a precipice movie. Like, it has, I think that's also why Galen Zemeckis didn't take off until the 80s, because their sensibility wasn't there. They were slightly ahead of their time. I do appreciate that, including being ahead of their time, they are using Wendy Jo Sperber yet again.
Sure.
Every time she shows up, she's so funny. She's one of the driving students, and she's just so distressed about how she's going to do.
Mr. Gerner, did I pass? Did I, Mr. Gerner? Did I pass the test?
Yes, yes, my dear. As long as you promise to get your license in another state.
She, like, can't even see over the steering wheel. She's like, she driving at high speed across the desert.
I mean, all of the teens in the driving thing are very
really
good.
So funny.
The whole team, that
just
whole
about killing
sequence,
the cops.
You know, even if this film was worse than I'm saying it is, it would still be worth it for that that cattle drive car stunt.
That sequence is so funny.
I was listening to people talk about this movie, and they're like, it's kind of weird that it's like a super shaggy 70s movie, and then it's like a tight as a drum action sequence for the last act.
I think there is
that both ways, because I also feel like this might have hit a little harder if it was more in like the Jimmy Carter malaise era, like 1979 1978, because there's so much like cynicism about America. But yeah, I don't know. It's very weird.
I've seen people point this towards being one of the last movies to poke fun at the working man, but I'm like, it's not. It's cheering
it's
for the working man. You're on his side. So yeah, I don't know. I thought that was very unusual.
Yeah, yeah, I would count them as working men. They're not making a lot of money.
They're hanging out bowling alleys.
They're screwing people for like $100.
What does Zemeckis and Gale have against highway builders? Because this Who Framed Roger Rabbit, they're all evil highway builders.
That was a real
builders.
Thing in LA, though, right? Like all the highways of the 60s and 70s, and how many people were displaced by that. And
true.
Poor
and
urban
I guess
planning.
The ending of like that travel across America, that way of life is ending, all those roadside people. Yeah, I don't know. They're the kings of the boomer nostalgia, so I guess it's like, it's the end of that way of life, Becky.
All right, the last thing I want to bring up before we bring this episode to a close is supposedly, because Spielberg was often on set to check out how things were going, and he read the first draft of the script, and apparently he was appalled at the idea that politicians could be corrupt, and he didn't like the line in there where they was said that the president lies. And apparently he was asking Galen Zemeckis to take it out. I'm like, do we think he's that much of an apple pier?
I mean, there's a lot of talk that like Milius and Spielberg set this up for Spielberg.
Yeah.
And then Spielberg kind of couldn't crack it. So, yeah, I mean, I think that he always kind of knew that Galen Zemeckis, why he admired them was their anarchic sort of comedy sensibility. And it's weird. Yeah, I don't know. He's a guy that him and comedy is a weird fit. And as much as I'm like, I don't know that I always love this movie, it's a hell of a lot better than 1941. And if you like Topps not being ripped off, you don't want to watch 1941.
Yeah, the bar's quite low.
I don't mind Topps being ripped off. I just want it to be consensual top ripping off. That's
no one ripped off this woman's top for her. She got it caught on the, what's it called, at the front of the car?
Yes.
The emblem, and
it's like, yeah, I was like, the
no
ornament.
One tackled her out of frame, which would have
that
would have
been
laugh.
A different assault. So, like,
that's true.
I'm not trying to defend these men who put this naked woman with bare tits on television. They also are like, they're also like, what we should say is they are making commercials by like hacking television signals.
Pirating broadcasts.
Yeah. So it's like not even like it, they're like, they interrupt specifically Jimmy Carter's presidential address, like you were saying, yes. Becky. And then all of a sudden there's, you know, the whole family's watching it and there's this naked woman.
So ridiculous. All right. I think that's where we need to end the episode. So Alicia Fletcher, once again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I would like to say that I was completely wrong about Peter O'Toole being in Kingdom of Heaven. He is in the other Orlando Bloom film that is like Kingdom of Heaven from the year before, Troy, and does not have leprosy. The person who has leprosy in Kingdom of Heaven is Edward Norton. I'm unclear how I got this confused. So I would like to apologize.
Okay. I mean, that's fine.
You know what? They're both very long-faced, gaunty sort of people. So I'm with you. We will get to this when we cover Kingdom of Heaven later, which I will sit through. It will be glorious. We have a great guest for that episode.
You contractually have to sit through it.
Yeah.
I do.
You've already signed up.
Cameron Maitland, thank you.
No
once
problem.
Again.
Yeah, like I say, darn a Chrysler Plymouth commercial with Kurt Russell on YouTube, and he's playing his character, basically being a slick salesman trying to sell you a car. It's very cute.
He's just so charming. All right, and you can join me next week where I'll have two special guests, Will Sloan and Justin DeClue of the Important Cinema Club, are back on the show, and this time we're talking about Corman and Creatures. It's Alligator and Humanoids from the Deep. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland, and featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.